Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaber.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Dame Helen Mirren, one of my favorite actresses of all time, one of my favorite people of all time. And she's had a very long career, which started off with, you know, really cutting her chops in traditional theater, but I've never seen her on the stage. I've only seen her in movies. And in fact, it turns out I had seen her in movies before I really knew who she was. My discovery of her was as Inspector Jane Tennyson on the Prime Suspect series, which was very popular and, you know, had several different seasons. And in it, she played what at the time was a very radical character. It was a woman taking over, you know, as a detective in a very male-dominated and misogynistic police force. And they, of course, are trying to find a serial killer. And so she has to play the game of being tough and yet still maintain her femininity to be able to take charge of a bunch of men who don't think that she should have the job in the first place. And she smokes continuously throughout the entire role, but she's so incredibly good at it. It was such a breakthrough role because I don't think people had seen a woman play that kind of role before.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned her in terms of the assertiveness, because she really is. I mean, she's the complete package, if you will, in terms of, you know, beauty and brains and a confident personality, all those things. But ironically, she had been around for a while before she truly broke through, hadn't she? I mean, she had solid stage training, as you say. She would perform at the Old Vic, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and she's continued to return to the stage periodically, even as Queen Elizabeth II in a stage play a few years ago. But the point to be made here along those very lines is that she made her screen debut in 1967, and she was working steadily, and I was aware of her. I'll mention some movies from the 1970s she was in: Savage Messiah, O Lucky Man, Caligula, the notorious Caligula, Long Good Friday, Excalibur, Mosquito Coast, a number of things. And she was getting attention at Pascale's Island, and I knew who she was, but somehow, like, it didn't go that next step, right? Like, I recognized her and I thought she was good, but then just like, you know, my mind goes elsewhere. The one movie that actually did get her quite a bit of recognition in that period, 1970s into 1980s, was Cal in 1984, where she plays an Irish Protestant widow. And she was acknowledged, she was really recognized there by winning the Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival. So people were starting to take notice, and I was too. But for me, you mentioned the breakthrough was the Prime Suspect TV series in the 1990s. And you're absolutely right in terms of popular recognition. In terms of art house recognition, you know, constantly working in movies and finally breaking through on the art house circuit, for me, here was the 1-2 punch. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover from 1989, it's a Peter Greenaway film. It was very much an art house hit. It didn't really get out to the malls, if you will. It's, you know, when you went to a theater like the Charles Theater in Baltimore or something, you'd see it there. But really, really very distinctive in that. That's the first punch. The second punch comes the next year, 1990, a film called The Comfort of Strangers. I actually met Helen Mirren at that time when she was doing Comfort of Strangers. I was at the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado. She was there with the film, as was its director, Paul Schrader. Now, I've got to say very quickly that I don't think it's a particularly profound film, certainly not as profound as it thinks it is, but it's a great looking film and it has great talent attached to it. Think about that. It's based on an Ian McEwan novel. The script was by Harold Pinter. The director is Paul Schrader. The cast includes not just Helen Mirren, but Christopher Walken, Rupert Everett, Natasha Richardson. This is A-list talent, right? And it's such a great looking film. Again, ultimately watching it, I don't think it quite holds up in terms of what I call profundity. I think it's claiming more profundity than it has. But boy, to watch it, it's a beautiful looking film. And she's so strong in it. So that 1-2 punch of the Peter Greenaway film and the Paul Schrader film got her a lot of critical recognition on what I call the art house circuit. And what you'll find in the years after that, and those films, 1989, 1990, that's just prior to the Prime Suspect show that you're talking about. What I'm getting at is that she's breaking through on the art house circuit after years of making films, some good and some not so good, but she's breaking through. She gets a lot of film work in the years after that. Some of these are straight out commercial ventures. Some are more art house circuit. Some are somewhere in between. And then you're absolutely right. It's really the TV series and her role as Detective Jane Tennyson that makes her score really big time. And when I met her, I was so struck by her self-confidence, her assertiveness, and how down to earth she was. She's really a very straightforward person. She doesn't put on airs. She's really direct. You know who you're dealing with. And she's just got it all. So I very much had a crush on her. I've got to tell you, I really thought, you know, she's really not just a terrific actor, but a terrific person.
Now, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover is one of the most disturbing movies I have ever seen. I just want to give people a heads up if they decide, oh, let's go to the back of the rack and dig up some of this old Helen Mirren stuff. That is a very, very disturbing movie, as is Caligula, which, you know, I saw that years and years after it came out because I'd heard so much about it. And, you know, what a surprise to find somebody like Helen Mirren involved in it at all. But actually, it's not, because, you know, you mentioned how down to earth she is. She's also apparently a nudist. So I guess there is an element of her that is a little bit more daring than the average person when it comes to that kind of thing. In Prime Suspect 7, the final act, she says to a junior, "Don't call me ma'am, I'm not the bloody queen." Which, of course, brings me to the fact that she has played a queen a total of 6 times. The Queen in 2006, Elizabeth I in 2005, The Prince of Egypt, 1998, The Snow Queen, 1995, The Madness of King George in 1994, and, of course, Caligula in 1979. Is she or is she not, Mike, the best person available today to play any sort of queen?
Well, what agreeable typecasting, right? I mean, she's got the person. Again, when I talk about that self-confidence, and you and I both talk about her assertiveness, who better to play a queen? When she stares you down, when she barks an order, you better believe me that, you know, this is something to do, right? You know, you're not going to, like, disagree with her at a time like that. What I want to do, actually, and the queen, I would argue, is probably her single greatest role. The director, Stephen Frears, has done a lot of good work, and I think he's just exceptional in directing the queen. And indeed, she won the Academy Award as Best Actress for that role, and it really is a kind of signature. And it led, actually, to one of her later stage roles, a play called The Audience, where she plays Elizabeth II again, which won her the, you know, Olivier Award. And in that one, she plays Queen Elizabeth, who's, you know, reminiscing with all the prime ministers she's met over the decades and so on. But again, playing Queen Elizabeth II, you know, all those times, and the other queens that you mentioned, I mean, who other than someone like Judi Dench could even come close in terms of that queen sweepstakes? But what I want to do is actually give a quote from Helen Mirren about playing the queen. Because again, this is a really smart actor. I mean, we talked about her in terms of, you know, her brains, her beauty and so on, but the smartness of crafting a character, of really understanding what Queen Elizabeth II would be like. Here's what she said about the queen in terms of playing a formidable figure like that. And here's the quote. "The queen always appears to be looking at the world. She's objective and steady. She is not repressed or neurotic. There's a sense of humor, but she remains a mystery. And I think it comes from living a life that nobody can ever comprehend. Remember, she has never drawn her own bath. Never stood on line in a shop. Her husband walks 2 paces behind her in public. It's a world we just can't fathom, and there's no escape from it for her."
That's a really interesting way of putting it, very insightful to sort of understand the kind of character that she's embodying. And I agree with you. I think that performance where she, in The Queen, is her best. It's such a difficult role to play because really it's meant to show what it was like right after Diana perished in that tunnel and the reaction that the British had to the Queen's seemingly indifference to the fact that her, you know, the mother of her grandchildren had just died. So it kind of shows you the stiff upper lip aspect of being the Queen, the "but this is how we've always done it" kind of aspect to her. But since it's Helen Mirren, you always sense the person inside, you know, trying to make sense of what can't be made sense of. And the quiet dignity that I imagine that the real queen has and that Helen Mirren definitely has. I mean, especially in, there's a scene where she's driving a Jeep, and apparently the real queen was pretty handy with a wrench and knew a lot about automobiles. And when she's, you know, when she gets stuck and she gets out to, you know, deal with the situation, she's so, it's not imperious, it's competent. And it's not something that you would expect to see from the queen. But I think Helen Mirren does a really great job in that movie of just humanizing her.
One of the things that Helen Mirren captures is that the queen is a very capable person in ever so many ways. Going back to the World War II years, when yes, whether driving a Jeep or riding a horse or, you know, taking a wrench and repairing something, there was that practical side to her and a kind of no-nonsense quality, right? Let's get on with it. Let's carry on, as the Brits would say. And it's one reason why she's really such a heroic figure, really, to have led the country so many decades and to be that figure of security and of stability. And yet also simultaneously, how isolating it must be, right? When you know, you are unapproachable in so many ways, and yet people look on you with awe. Well, what must it be like to be the queen when you have that kind of zone or circle around you where people are only approaching so far, only saying so much, how ironically isolating it could be to be there. And then trying to figure out how to handle the death of Diana. I mean, you know, what to say or to what extent to show emotion, because, you know, that's a big issue for royalty. When should you show emotion? And it was, you know, something that the film The Queen dealt with quite overtly and quite powerfully. So by way of consumer advice, if people want to watch Helen Mirren films, among the early films, there are quite a few worth seeing, actually, like A Lucky Man and Cal, certainly. But you're absolutely right with your cautionary note. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover is a very disturbing film. So, you know, be advised that we're not sending you to that one, but if you venture out on your own, yeah, you've been forewarned. Likewise, The Comfort of Strangers, that was the film where I met her when she was doing it. It's a dark film, it's a disturbing film. So in terms of friendlier subject matter, you know, Cal certainly from the very early career would be something to keep in mind. Films like Madness of King George, Gosford Park, you know, there are a number of films where she's quite good, but more than anything, I would emphasize starting with The Queen. Start at the top, right? Go to The Queen. Watch that from 2006. Some other films we can talk about now would include films like Calendar Girls from 2003. And, you know, she's done some very commercial work in recent years. Some of it's quite good. So why don't we talk about those?
You mentioned that she won the Oscar. She says that she did not cry. She says, I did not cry when I got my Oscar, but I cried when applauded by baggage handlers at Heathrow Airport. I had my Oscar in my bag, so I got it out. I was shameless, but they loved it. I like the fact that she enjoyed that little moment in that way. Let's go on to Calendar Girls, and I'll also preface that with another one of her quotes saying, as you get older, naked stuff gets easier. And I mention that because Calendar Girls is based on a true story of a group of Yorkshire women who produced a nude calendar to raise money for leukemia research under the auspices of the Women's Institutes. And this is a great movie. It might be considered a chick flick because it's, you know, it's about women who are all part of this group that gets together and talks about, you know, the best way to plant your garden and how to, you know, make plum jam and stuff like that. So it's very, it seems very housewifey and very small townish, and everybody knows everybody, and all the women who live there are all part of this group. And for them to do something so daring, you know, when they're actually going through with the photography and everything, they're like, well, you know, this is going to be tasteful because, you know, this isn't France, you know, so it's very British, stiff upper lip, but yet very daring. And they all do take off their clothes and make a lot of money with the calendar. Although Helen Mirren herself says she is famous for being cool about not being gorgeous.
Well, really, going back to her early career, she had a number of roles that either required nudity or at least were, you know, somewhat cutting edge or daring for the time. And I'll put it this way, she's never been shy about that, right? And it's part of the kind of down-to-earth quality she has that, well, what does the character call for? What's the role call for? And she has enough confidence as a performer. But, you know, there's a kind of bittersweet irony kicking in here, because when she was young and beautiful, some of the roles she played were casting her with that in mind, you know what I mean? That not always maybe giving her the complete opportunity for acting chops, right? You know, that she was cast because of the physical appearance, you know, as a young actress. And that partly explains why, you know, when she gets in a film like Caligula, she's an established actor already at that point, but how are they casting her? What kind of roles does she get offered? And I think that's sort of a bittersweet thing for an actress who is blessed with physical beauty as to how she gets cast in films, you know, because you don't control your own destiny completely, right? What the producers offer you. And so some of the roles, like in the 60s and through the 70s, don't, I think, fully take advantage of her acting talent. There's the physical appearance, there's the physicality, and she's really good with all that. I'm not, you know, denigrating any of that. I think she's really quite effective, but they weren't giving her some of the more psychologically complex roles or more nuanced roles that goodness knows she has seized upon in the decades since then.
That makes me think of her role as Alma Hitchcock in the movie Hitchcock, where I think also she did really, really good work. And that's kind of a thankless role in a way, because she has to play, you know, the woman behind the throne, which is really what Alma Hitchcock did. You know, she dimmed her star to stand behind her husband, but she was involved in every one of his productions. But in real life, not a great beauty, which doesn't mean she didn't have other wonderful qualities. But see, that's a tough role for a woman to take on, because you have to sort of hide your little light under a bushel in order to not overwhelm the character itself.
Well, years ago, I interviewed Pat Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock's daughter, and, you know, spoke with her and also with Hitchcock's granddaughter. And we talked a lot about Alma, because Alma was not just the wife, but the advisor. Hitchcock relied on his wife, Alma, for so much advice, but it's not just at the kitchen table level, because back in the 1930s in particular, she had quite a few screen credits as a screenwriter, advisor, this or that, and she worked on productions. And in later decades, she was more behind the scenes, but he always relied so completely on what Alma thought, her advice. So on the one hand, yes, the power behind the throne, or, you know, the person not as well known to the general public, everything you're saying about her. But on the other hand, she was not exactly shy about giving her opinion. Alma would always, you know, let Alfred know exactly what she thought of a film, and he listened to her. And he worried about it. He was nervous about it. He would show his films to Alma just before they went into general release. And, you know, he was always like, well, dear, did you like it? And sometimes she had qualms and reservations, and he would get a little worked up. One of my favorite involves Psycho. Before Psycho went out into the theaters, he had his own print, and they're sitting in the living room basically watching it at home before it goes out to the public. And when it was over, he was like the nervous husband, like, well, Alma, what'd you think? She said, well, you can't release it. And he said, what do you mean I can't release it? She said, well, in the famous shower scene where Janet Leigh's been stabbed and she's dying, you know, her head's down on the porcelain there and her life's literally going down the drain. And in that moment, in a close-up, you can see her swallow. And Alma said, you know, you can see her swallow there, you know, you can't release it. Well, this was long before computer-generated effects and, you know, fixing things at the last moment. And they finally just let it go out like that. And Hitchcock gave it a kind of generous reading of, well, it's like a reflexive thing, you know? I mean, she's dead, but still the body twitching kind of thing there. But Alma would be very direct with things like that. She would say, well, this is wrong or that's wrong, or you can see Janet Leigh swallowing in the bathtub. And so she wasn't at all shy, as I say, about offering her advice that way. But the challenge for Helen Mirren, and she gives a terrific performance, is, on the one hand, yes, she is behind the scenes. She's like, the kitchen advisor, if you will, for the later career of Hitchcock. She was more on the set for some of the earlier films. And so you've got that sort of submissive quality and, you know, sort of an ordinary looking person who's, you know, not in the public eye as much. On the other hand, though, she really was herself really smart and perceptive. And as I say, not at all shy about expressing herself. So what Helen Mirren has to do is convey both those things, right? Which might seem to be at odds with each other. In talking with Pat Hitchcock, she said, you know, her mother was really, really outspoken, you know, within the household, talking with her husband and so on. And yet he was the public face. He was such a famous film director. All the spotlight would go on him. But she was very much there.
You know, apparently in the beginning of their relationship, Alma Hitchcock had a better job than Alfred Hitchcock did at the studios. He had the job of, you know, drawing the intertitles, and she had a better job. So it wasn't until they offered him a picture to direct that he was, you know, he felt he could even approach her to ask her out. So I think since they started out with that sort of dynamic, I think he probably always felt comfortable with using her as a sounding board and relying on her opinion. Apparently, she was involved in every single script he produced into a movie. And that kind of comes across in the movie, that idea that she's very, no shrinking violet. And not everybody can give that sort of performance the way Helen Mirren does, because you can just see her totally running everything and writing all the scripts.
Well, this is a loaded subject because it depends on who you ask. I've interviewed some of Hitchcock's scriptwriters over the years, and John Michael Hayes, for instance, was totally congruent with that notion that Alma was very influential. Even if she's not always credited in the script, she's there working on it and advising and so on. And in the early career, yes, you see her name on a lot of the early credits. So that's the one extreme. John Michael Hayes saying she's always active that way. The other extreme surprised me, actually. It was an interview with Charles Bennett, who was Hitchcock's main screenwriter in the 1920s and 1930s. And I was at a program where Charles Bennett was to have appeared live, but he was in his upper 90s, not in good health. So we had a phone tap in. We were able to get his voice and at least listen to him. And Bennett surprised us because he said, you know what? He said, when you watch some of the early Hitchcock films, you see Alma's name popping up in the credits. And you would think, well, she's very much there working on the script and so on. And Bennett, to our great surprise, said, well, you know, that wasn't always completely the case. Hitchcock always had a keen appreciation of money, of overseeing a budget, you know, whether he was the actual producer or not, of overseeing the budget and getting his salary. And Bennett told us that what Hitchcock would do is when the production budget was being worked up, Hitchcock would have his own credit line as the director and whatever the salary was for that. And then he would build in a credit line for Alma, and there would be Alma's salary also factored in. And that, you know, she certainly was there offering advice and so on, but that it wasn't always everything it might have seemed from reading screen credits. You know what I mean? You read the credits and you think, oh, well, she, you know, she's co-scriptwriter and so on. And it was Charles Bennett himself. Who would know? If anyone would know, right? He's Hitchcock's major screenwriter then. And so again, when I say it depends on how you ask, various Hitchcock screenwriters that I've either talked to or at least listened to have not always themselves been in agreement. But what I think we can all agree on is that Alma was very much a great influence on Hitchcock that way, not just as the spouse, but as a creative partner. And back to Helen Mirren, that Helen Mirren really captures that quality of someone who's quietly there, but very much there.
Now, apparently she was offered a role in Hitchcock's Frenzy, Helen Mirren, which she turned down. And I wonder if she regrets that, because I think she would have been an outstanding Hitchcock blonde. Smart, unflappable. I think they could have done really great things in movies together. I think that's one of those missed opportunities. But I wanted to mention another one of her movies where she also plays very competent and confident, great role for a woman to play and put out there, which is her role in Eye in the Sky, which is directed by Gavin Hood, a director I like very much. And she is fantastic in it as a military person in charge of a operation where they have determined a home where some terrorists are packing up some weapons to go do something nefarious. But meanwhile, outside, there's a little girl with a hula hoop. So a great movie, by the way, in terms of the insect-like drones that they send to spy and take a look at what's going on inside the house. And just the, you know, the impending doom. You know something's going to happen. Either the terrorists are going to blow something up or they're going to blow up the terrorists. But it's that, you know, the terrible question, you know, do you save the life of the one at the expense of the many? And of course, they make it harder by it being a child, but an interesting dynamic of choices. And of course, Helen Mirren, unflappable and in charge at the center.
I'm so glad you mentioned that film because it's an example of how I was talking earlier about the art house circuit, some of the films that really made her known to that kind of moviegoer. But in terms of the general moviegoing public, she has done a number of what I'd call box office films, commercial, you know, mainstream films, and she has really good judgment for the most part, doesn't she? I mean, the film you mentioned is really smart entertainment. It's really well made. You know, I really like that film, and she's perfectly cast. You want someone with that degree of confidence. And it's not just a matter of the scripted dialogue. When you get a close-up of her face, it's almost like she's still playing the queen or something. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You know, who could go against her? Who would dare to talk back, you know, when she says do this or do that? But again, that's the physicality of it, that she has the confidence as a performer to know how to, actors would say, hold the frame. She knows how to hold the frame that way. And so the film itself, as I say, is really entertaining. And a large part of it is just that when she's on screen, you have a degree of confidence in the audience as well, right? That you know you're in good hands there in terms of the acting and what she'll do with it. And I think it's actually one of her stronger recent roles. What do you think?
I completely agree. I think it's definitely one to see. If you haven't seen it and you like Helen Mirren, you really should see her in this. This is one of those movies that makes you realize, you know, I don't think most people really would have trouble with women in power in the military or anywhere else, as long as they can embody that sort of and engender that sort of trust and belief. Not everybody can pull that off.
Well, you know what? A few times during our discussion, you've mentioned those assertive qualities she has. And let's talk about this a little bit more in terms of how it really dovetails with this latest wave of feminism, to put it rather awkwardly, in terms of go back to Prime Suspect. Why did that become a hit? Because of the kind of assertive female protagonist that she plays, right?
Right.
And when you look at some of the film roles she has from that period onward, you really see that, yes, she's been around for decades and she's done some good work, but it seems like in these most recent decades, she's done her best work. What do you think of that? Because it seems to me that, you know, that we're talking about a film career, an acting career, but it really dovetails, it really goes along synchronously with what's going on, you know, with women in general in terms of playing people in power, in terms of assuming power, whether political or in the showbiz. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think she also has a very warm quality that comes out in a movie like The 100-Foot Journey, which I don't think is one of her best movies, but I think she's great in it. Even if she's in a movie where the movie's not all that great, I'm also thinking of Woman in Gold and the two Red movies, she's still always the best thing in it.
For me, those scenes with her almost make films like that worthwhile. You know what I mean? The films you've just mentioned, they're not particularly good, right? They're sort of forgettable. Like you see them, you say, yeah, is that not bad, right? But when she's in them, maybe just a handful of scenes, but when she's on, she's really on. And I feel like as I'm exiting the theater, I'm thinking, well, it wasn't a total waste. You know, it was not just Helen Mirren, but Helen Mirren, you know, really, really turning it on in a scene or two. And you know what, you know, all joking aside, sometimes that's enough, right? You see a film that's just, it's okay. But boy, when she's there, she's really there.
You know, in terms of what she should do next, I think it would be interesting if they revisited the whole prime suspect idea now, because I think it would be hard to sell the idea today that, you know, there's all these men who simply can't get around the idea of working for a woman. I think that idea is sort of passe now, although at the time it was groundbreaking. But it would be interesting to see her do, you know, a sort of up-to-date Inspector Jane Tennyson.
I wouldn't be surprised at some point if a producer didn't exactly, you know, say the same thing and pitch it to her that way. What do you think, though? How well would it work? Because Prime Suspect, it's very much of the 1990s. I mean, how would it play now? How would it be, when I say packaged now, I mean creatively, how would you see it shaping up? I mean, let's pretend, if you will, that we're the producers, we're the scriptwriters, we're going to offer her this. What would you be offering her?
Well, she would be running the police department. And it would be some sort of, it would be a police procedural movie. But this time she would be in charge and you get past all of the, yeah, but we can't work with you because you're a woman. And you just start with the fact that it's Helen Mirren, she's Jane Tennyson, it's 2020, attitudes have changed. Now what can she do if she doesn't have to fight with the people supposed to be working under her to solve the problems? You know, what's now possible with that character now that times have changed?
That's a really good observation. I think it would work that way creatively. And after all, you know, a criminal case is a criminal case, right? You wouldn't have some of those other issues that you dealt with in the 90s, but the cases themselves could be very much of the moment. Whatever's of the moment in 2020, you could have her working on that. And people wouldn't be carping like, well, you know, but she's a woman, you know, can I believe her? Should I follow her? That would be moot, right? That wouldn't be an issue for the most part. But the case itself would still be the case itself.
They'd have to cut out all the smoking references too, because that was one of the things that made her, you know, not trustworthy or whatever, is that, you know, she smokes. It was like played up as a real flaw. See, today you wouldn't even have her smoking. You know, they would just leave that out altogether. They would have to find some other ways to make her both flawed and relatable.
Here's a social observation. When you watch recent Hollywood movies, very few characters smoke. I mean, you know, back in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, not just Bogart, but, you know, any number of actors, it's one cigarette after another. What would Bette Davis be without a cigarette? What would Humphrey Bogart be without a cigarette, right? And so that's a whole separate discussion in some ways. But when you watch movies now, the extent to which, you know, it might be a beautifully furnished house, but there's no ashtray. You know, nobody smokes anymore there. And I think if you were to retool an older series, by older, I mean Prime Suspect from the 1990s, that's actually one of the things, and it's quite interesting, what would change in terms of attitudes and also in terms of habits? You're absolutely right. I mean, I don't think smoking would factor in at all. What do you think?
I think you're right, Mike. But whatever Helen Mirren does next, I will go see. I would go listen to her read the ingredients off the back of an ibuprofen bottle. I think she's just great at everything she does. So Dame Helen Mirren, you have my vote for every Oscar that comes after, no matter what you're in. And that kind of brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check us out online for other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.